Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting on Human Services Finance to order. We have a quorum present. I will first move the approval for the minutes for the prior meeting, which was February 9th, 2023. Vice Chair Banner, you read the minutes and ready to move the approval?
I have read the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move the meeting minutes for February 9th.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair Brenner moves the approval for the minutes for February 9, 2023. Discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for February 9, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we do have a few bills in front of us today, and hopefully we will end on time. The first bill that we have is House File 585, Representative Cleveland. So the motion for this bill is I move that House File 585 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Madam Chair, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and move with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. I am State Representative Ginny Cleavorn, and I'm bringing forward House File 585. Over the years, we've had many conversations about our shared goal to increase access to services that support older Minnesotans and individuals living with disabilities and complex health needs to remain living in their homes and with their families for as long as possible. This goal is now more important than ever, given the strain on our congregate care settings. House File 585 is a bipartisan effort written in conjunction with the Minnesota Home Care Association, and it contains specific and concrete steps that we can take to move in this direction. The bill proposes a collection of changes aimed at moving the medical assistant reimbursement rates for underfunded home care services and activities to be closer to the actual cost of providing these services. These changes proposed in the bill will start to move us towards a more sustainable system of access to home care services. This is a critical piece of our work as a state to support older Minnesotans and individuals living with disabilities and complex health needs to remain living independently in their homes and therefore avoiding needed access to more intensive or expensive services. The bill proposes three changes. First, it updates the reimbursement rate for homemaker services to address the current extremely low wages that can be paid under that critical service. Second, it establishes a separate reimbursement rate for a limited annual number of care evaluation visits, recognizing the actual cost of those required care evaluation visits. And third, the bill requires the Minnesota Department of Human Services to work with the home care stakeholders to identify a care coordination reimbursable service aimed at recognizing at least a small amount of the care coordination work currently being performed by home care staff without reimbursement. I would like to thank Representative Keel and you, Chair Noor, for joining me as co-authors on this bill. I would also like to draw members' attentions to letters of support that have been sent to the committee, as well as the governor's inclusion of this inclusion of a portion of this proposal in his recently released budget proposal. The proponents of this bill have been communicating with DHS about this bill for over 2 years and will continue to work with DHS. I would like to bring to your attention, Chair Noor, that I do have an A1 amendment to the bill.
I see you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to move right now the A1 amendment?
I would just like to explain quickly the A1 and then...
I will move the A1 amendment for Representative Cleavon. Please proceed with the explanation of the A1 amendment.
Thank you very much. The A1 amendment is to conform the language to the language that was passed in the Senate. The DHS and the Home Care Association have been continuing to work on this legislation, and there are two changes I would particularly like to call your attention to. On line 1.22, and Ms. Meserly will discuss this in more detail later, it is the insertion of the number 300 related to rate payment and that is a home care association change. And then if you will flip to page 2, line 11, you will see delete section 14 and insert a new section 14. It is my understanding this is DHS preferred language. So as you are holding this bill over, there may still be other changes that would need to be incorporated at another time. But that is the A1 at this moment.
Any discussion, members, on A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. So, with that to the bill as amended.
And since I've given an introduction of the bill, I think it would be best for us just to move to testifier Kathy Messerly. She's the executive director of the Minnesota Home Care Association and with me now.
Ms. Messerly, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much. Chair Noren, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Messerly, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Home Care Association. Our members provide hands-on care to approximately 40,000 older Minnesotans and individuals with disabilities and complex health needs in their home. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 585, a targeted approach aimed at three specific home care services that are most challenging for providers as they are under or non-reimbursed, as Representative Cleavorn just mentioned. More and more home care agencies are limiting their services or even closing their doors due to the workforce shortage. This has led to more individuals turning to more intensive, expensive, and currently overly stressed hospitals and long-term care settings. It's a challenging cycle, as hospitals are then unable to safely discharge patients back to their homes due to the lack of available home care. The bill has three parts. First, it establishes a new reimbursement rate for a limited number of care evaluation visits. This change is aimed at implementing reimbursement rate closer to the actual cost that providers incur for three specific kinds of home care evaluations. All three visits are required and are more comprehensive than a typical home care visit, taking 2 to 3 times as long as a standard visit, which is what the current reimbursement rate is actually set at. Service plans are developed. They're revisited and adjusted during these evaluations, which include the start of care, secondly, recertification done every 60 days, and lastly, a resumption of care when there is an interruption in service such as a hospital stay. Secondly, the bill directs DHS to collaborate with stakeholders to identify billable medical assistance services for care coordination activities. This section of the bill is aimed at recognizing at least a small amount of the care coordination work currently being performed without any reimbursement. Examples include reaching out to a pharmacy or a doctor or additional guidance or orders. The additional reimbursement would only cover outside of the patient home. And the follow-up testimony provided by Sue Morgan will describe a little bit more about it, but as Representative Cleavorn stated, just a little bit more on the amendment is that the current public health nurse assessment for PCA services is $276, and what we are proposing is just shy of $250. And these evaluations are actually more complex, including medication reconciliation. So it's based on the evaluations that our providers tell us, which takes 3 times the amount as a standard visit, as I mentioned. Finally, the bill restructures the reimbursement rate for homemaker services to be more reflective of current market data. Homemaker services are a critical but often overlooked service that enables people to stay in their home. The current rate for homemaker services does not allow for a livable wage to be paid. More agencies have discontinued offering that service simply because they cannot hire anyone at that low wage. Our state can and must do better. This bill is a step in that direction. I ask for your support of House File 585, and I'm happy to address questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Morelli. I think we will have more questions, so let's hear from Ms. Morgan. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members.
My name is Susan Morgan, and I am the Chief Operating Officer at ACRA and a registered nurse who has worked in home care for over 40 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 585. ACRA is a nonprofit organization founded 30 years ago to focus on the underserved. Our mission is to improve lives by providing support to clients who may be chronically ill or disabled in all 87 counties in Minnesota. At ACRA, we see every day how the underfunding of various home care services and activities impacts those who are in dire need of these services. The section of this bill proposing an update to the reimbursement rate for homemaker services is very much needed. Homemaker service is commonly the first home care service that a client needs. As the body declines, these homemaker tasks become more difficult to manage independently. Unkempt homes with loads of laundry undone, dishes stacked high, attracting all kinds of vermin was something that we regularly saw at public health when investigating vulnerable adult cases. We would often refer these individuals for homemaker services. Years ago, the reimbursement rates were adequate to attract and pay staff to provide this type of work, but honestly, it's no longer the case. In addition, home care agencies have for years absorbed the high cost of starting or resuming care for a client in the home. An RN must do an in-depth evaluation visit, which can take up to 2 hours in the home, as well as another 2 to 3 hours of documentation once back in the office. And yet these evaluations are just reimbursed as a regular visit. Another task that home care agencies are not reimbursed for is care coordination. This involves advocating for clients in many ways. It might be to track down necessary equipment or medications that a client was not sent home with from the hospital, or making arrangements for them to access Meals on Wheels when better nutrition is needed. This is also an unreimbursed service. I ask for your support of this proposal to help more Minnesotans get access to the supports that they need to remain living in their own homes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Morgan. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? See none. Member discussions. Representative Zelesnicker.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. And thank you for being here. I understand the time it takes for the nurse assessments for new admissions and change of condition. So my question is to the reimbursement rate for the homemakers for that piece. Can you let the committee know what the average rate right now is for the homemaker, and then also what the proposal would be, if you have any statistics? Thank you.
Executive Director Messler.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, Representative Zelesnicker. Currently, the homemaker rates are reimbursed at $4 to $5 per 15-minute units. We do not have further statistics and are working with DHS and would work with DHS to determine what that would be going forward.
Follow up, Representative Zelesnicker.
Thank you. So I'm just trying to look at this for the continuum, because we have many, many programs to put in place here. So I just wanted to see what we're paying a homemaker. So in a grid, it's going to make sense. This is the most cost-effective way to reach people is in the homes. So I support that 100%. I just want to make sure we have a grid-based system that's going to follow for CNA, from homemaker wages to PCA wages for disabilities and people in group homes and assisted livings, and then what we're paying CNAs in the most skilled setting of licensed nursing homes and or hospitals. So this could be $16 an hour to $20 an hour right now. And then their episodic visits, if I understand it right, they could be there for 1 hour, they could be there for 3 hours, correct?
Ms. Nussler.
Yes, Chair and Representative. That's the reimbursement rate, so that's not the actual hourly wage. I should clarify what I was indicating.
Yep.
Representative Zelesnicker.
Thanks. That's what I wanted to know. So it's the reimbursement rate to you, to
yes,
the provider,
Exactly.
And so then the wages, do we have any data on what a homemaker wage is in the state right now?
Yes, and I don't think I have that with me, so I may need to get back to you on that to make sure that I'm accurate. I just don't want to misspeak, but we'd be happy to follow up.
Thank you. No further questions.
Lead New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cleburne, I wonder if you can just tell us briefly, your effective dates include upon federal approval. Do these changes require CMS approval?
Thank you so much, Chair Noor and Representative New Burnley. I will have to ask Ms. Messerly to answer that question.
Thank you. Ms. Messerly.
Chair Noor, Representative, it's our understanding from DHS that they believe it might require CMS's approval, which is why that language is in there.
Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. As I looked at it, I didn't know that it would. So I appreciate that that's a just-in-case.
Any further questions from members or discussions? Just wanted to follow up on the reimbursement rate. So I see this is increasing MA, medical assistant reimbursement to 300%. For skilled nursing, I believe. What will that equate to?
The 300% would be just shy of $250. It's a few cents shy of $250.
What is the current rate at this moment for the skilled?
It's $87 in some cents. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact cents, but...
No problem, Ms. Smith. Yeah. I think we'll follow up to know exactly what is the scale that we're changing and the difference between other services where the same skill set is required. So I think we'll have more discussions as we contemplate on what needs to be done when we decide on the budget this year. So thank you so much. See no further discussions. I renew my – well – Chair Cleburne, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I'm very thankful for your consideration of this bill and for holding it over for possible inclusion. I know that this is a very important and necessary service for our families, and I just ask that you please work to the betterment for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Cleburne. So I renew my motion that House File 585, as amended, be laid over. Thank you. We'll have more conversation on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1067. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, members of the committee. I am here to present to you House File 1067. If you're on the Human Services Policy Committee, you heard about this bill, and so thank you for indulging me in hearing about it again. So thank you, members. This bill was heard and supported last year. It was House File 4085. This year, again, it's 1067, and it seeks to build upon the past efforts to allow PCAs to drive their clients to a variety of destinations. This is supposed to roll out with the Community First Services and Supports, or CFSS, program. However, the implementation of that program is still very far out, and this bill addresses an immediate need in the meantime. Currently, PCAs are not allowed to drive their clients as a part of the service plan. Even if a person with disabilities has their own adapted vehicle but needs someone to drive it, providers and agencies cannot be reimbursed for the time spent driving. Providers have been told that if the PCA does drive their client, the PCA has to clock out while driving and clock back in at the destination. And this means that the agency has to pay the PCA for the time, but that they can't bill for the time the PCA spends driving. So this bill will allow IADLs, or Instrumental Activities of Daily Living, in the PCA program to include client transportation. This is far more affordable than other transportation options or the cost of a waiver for transportation services. In many places, especially in Greater Minnesota, there are few to no alternatives for transportation for people with disabilities, which makes it so difficult, if not impossible, for them to get to work, to school, to volunteer, to shop, and so on. Lack of transportation is a leading cause of unemployment for people with disabilities. This is a matter of empowering people with disabilities and embracing their right to self-determination and their inherent dignity. Living with a disability should not restrict one's access to move about in the world in the ways that they need to. And with that, I would ask for your support on this bill, and I will turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. I would like to move House File 1067, be laid over for possible inclusion. To the first testifier, I have Ms. Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noir and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also an autistic adult. I'm here today to talk to you about House File 1067, which would change personal care assistance to allow driving as an instrumental activity of daily living. I have personal care attendants, or PCAs. I have three of them. This surprises a lot of people because it's often thought that PCAs exist to help people get out of bed or with bathing or with physical mobility. In my case, my staff are tasked with supporting me in my home, but also in the community. They monitor my behaviors and they help me manage anxiety so I can be safe in the community. They help with executive function, making sure I'm eating and going to bed at a reasonable hour, which is a big challenge during session. They're there to make sure that I can live a fully inclusive life and reach my goals. They go with me to the grocery store, to the gym, to community events, doctor's appointments, and more. But they don't drive me while working. I drive us, or they meet me there. Last summer, we attended a festival. I love art and food trucks, and I really wanted to experience this celebration. It was too much. I had a complete and total meltdown, and thankfully, my PCA was with me. They got me safely back to my vehicle, and then we sat there in July in a car for 2 hours while I calmed down enough to be able to safely drive. Because my PCA could not legally drive me while working. This is ridiculous. I'm lucky. I can drive myself and my PCA most of the time. But what about those that can't? Most people with autism don't qualify for metro mobility, and general public transportation can be a sensory challenge. And what about children with disabilities that have PCAs? 8-year-olds are clearly not driving themselves. For many people on the autism spectrum, PCAs are there as behavioral support, and the place that we need support most is in the community. DHS defines PCA services' purpose as to help a person with day-to-day activities in their home and community. And the Minnesota Choice Assessment goes beyond activities of daily living and includes instrumental activities of daily living, such as accompany to medical appointments out in the community, assist paying bills, complete household tasks related to the ADL needs, plan and prepare meals, shop for food and clothing and other essential items. These are things that take place in our community. It also assesses for behavioral support, such as observation or redirection of behaviors. This takes place outside of the home. We need to have a mechanism that allows PCAs to be paid to assist us outside the home, regardless of our own driving status. Changes to the statute to allow PCAs to drive is necessary for the state to continue to be in alignment with the Olmstead Plan. I am allowed to receive services in the least restrictive environment, and the least restrictive environment is my community, not just my home. Thank you so much today for your time and support of this important legislation.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Nelson. I think you said it well. So we'll go to the next testifier, Mr. Jeff. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Noor, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bangsberg, and I'm a disability advocate. I live in the city of New Hope, and I've been here on and off for a number of years, advocating for other bills and this bill. In your packets, you have a letter from Ted Stamp, who is unable to be here today because his PCA can't drive him here, and he lives in Marshall, Minnesota. But he's an employed individual that lives in Southwest Minnesota and has a very good case about why he should be able to drive. And this used to be allowed. It wasn't an issue Years ago, all one needed to do was to demonstrate you had a valid driver's license and to demonstrate that you had a vehicle that showed proof of insurance. And then once those two issues had been addressed, it was allowed. And then all of a sudden, it was no longer an allowed activity. Well, now it's allowed activity, but not while a PCA is working. And we're very fortunate that it was worked into the bill 2 years ago with the help of the Department of Human Services and Ms. Christy Guam, and helped put this into the CFSS. CFSS has been on the books for 10 years. We're waiting for that to get implemented. They're having issues getting it implemented with the federal government, and it still has not to this date been implemented. And we still are unclear as to when it will. We heard maybe this April, maybe. The concern is, once it is implemented, it's going to take at least another year for people to slowly get rolled into this program so people can have their PCAs in compliance to drive them around in the community without getting in trouble or having somebody coming down on them and saying, no, you can't do this. All other waivered services allow for this. I also must point out that this does not technically add to the service plan. The service plan is determined by activities of daily living, as far as the amount of time that a PCA is allowed to care for an individual. But instrumental activities of daily living are not allowed to be counted as time on that care plan. So it does not increase the amount of time that that client bills. It's the unused authorized hours is where we're seeing where we have to generate a fiscal note, which in my opinion is criminal, but that's my opinion. I no longer drive. My wife will tell you that she's a happier person because of it. And I'll leave it at that, and I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Banks, for your testimony, and I'm sure your wife will be happy to find someone driving you. And so thank you so much for your advocacy. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? See none. Member discussions? Representative Zalesnicker.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I'm thrilled about this. I mean, I think having the ability to have drivers and the PCAs has been something I've wanted for a long time. My question is, the insurance part must have got worked out, because the liability and where the liability flows was always a question for the employee or the employer and the client. So I'm assuming, I don't see any of that language in here, but I'm assuming that must have been addressed. Thank you.
Mr. Bank.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that the insurance issue that was with the providers, and one thing that we've always made it clear is, if a provider is uncomfortable, they do not have to allow their employees to do this activity. The client can go and find another provider elsewhere if that provider is unwilling to do so. But I've been told by people in the industry, and we have providers in the room, that the liability insurance is covered under their general waiver obligations, and it's nominal at best. Because they have to cover for all expenses for employees throughout the community. Is that correct? Do I get a nod or yes? Or okay. Thank you.
It's always good to phone a friend.
Thank you,
Mr. Banks. Yeah. Representative Zalesnicker. You can pull it. I have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. Thank you both for speaking so eloquently to the challenges of the current system as it is. I'm remembering one of the presentations I think that we got from one of the departments about how many of our folks, I think, in the disability community have to change vehicles at a lot of the county lines. And my district bumps right up to Carver County. So I'm imagining, you know, the challenges that should PCAs not be allowed to drive their clients while they're working, and the limited options outside of that, imagining my my constituents driving to the end of Hennepin County, changing into a vehicle in Carver County, and just going, you know, 5 to 10 minutes down the road just to Chanhassen to a service that they may need to access there. So I think that this is really important. It's common sense, and I'm glad that we're able to work it out. Thank you.
Mr. Vanspach, I know you wanted to read that. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for that. That's a very excellent point of why we think it will cost less money than what the state will realize in the long run and not have to do all of that rigmarole, and also causing extra time for an individual to be out there getting cold or whatever, or rained on, for crying out loud, in the middle of February. And so it's a common sense bill. My concern, though, is timing. We've been working on this for 3 years, and my fear is if it gets thrown into the omnibus bill, we'll have to wait till the end of May, and then we're going to have to wait again. And so I'm hoping we can get this done sooner than later, but thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I just also wanted to comment, in the transition from human services policy to human services finance, we have broad support on both sides of the aisle to bring this to the floor as soon as possible. So that is in the plans. We have a few amendments that we would like to make sure we're coordinating with the Senate side, with the chair, and with some other initiatives before we make that a final move. So we just want to be very clear that before we bring this to the floor, we have a fiscal note, and we make sure that we also have all of the bugs worked out as well. So just wanted to put that on the record as well.
Great. Yes. So I think that is much needed for us to have a clear bill before we vote for it and send it to the floor. So we're looking forward to the fiscal note once we have the February focus, which is coming within a few days from now. So Lead Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was about timing, actually. It says that this is going to be effective 90 days following approval from CMS, I assume. Clearly, this has been done in other states. I just texted my son, who's a PCA in another state, and said, can you drive clients? Yes, he can. So my question is, do you have any idea what that timing might look like before this can actually get done?
Is it for Ms. Nelson or from the department in terms of explaining the timeline? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. In our human services policy conversation, this came up as well, so I see the wonderful Christy Graum making her way over here. But in short, it is expected that 90 days, if I'm quoting her correctly, should be about the right time. So I'll let her answer that, but we have talked about this, and then she can give you some more details. It's just a very finely tuned process to make sure we can get that CMS approval and everything.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. So that, just to clarify, the question is around why is there a 90-day buffer in there?
No. Mr. Chair.
Lead Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I'm actually wondering, the 90 days following federal approval is fine. I'm wondering what that federal approval process is going to look like.
I see.
And do we anticipate that going relatively quickly? Is that going to be a laborious process? What is the timing overall, do we think, on this bill?
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. We oftentimes do not know how laborious the process is going to be with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But, you know, we do work very hard to establish a good relationship with them, and we're in ongoing conversations with them around community first services and supports, for example. So we do feel that this particular change would require just a state plan amendment. So it's not as rigorous as CFSS and all of the various federal authorities that requires. So just a state plan amendment. And given that this is something that's already a part of CFSS, we do think that it will be a fairly streamlined process. Of course, we don't know for sure. We're thinking conservatively it might take about 4 months or so to get approval. But as members have heard, and you've probably heard it, things are backed up at CMS these days. So we will be hopeful and do our best to get this approved as soon as possible.
Lead Newbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Graham, I think you mentioned CFSS for the benefit of everyone to know. What is CFSS? When are we anticipating? As I know Mr. Banks, like, said, maybe April. So just wanted to put on the record in case of people who are not aware of where we're transitioning to.
Mr. Chair, CFSS stands for Community First Services and Supports, and so this is the program that will be replacing what we know of today as the PCA program. In many respects, it's very similar to PCA. Some of the differences are it allows for more peer self-direction, so people are able to really be in the driver's seat and be able to hire their own workers and make determinations around how they spend their budget. When they choose the budget model, which is now what's known as PCA Choice. CFSS also allows people to be able to purchase goods, which is something the PCA program doesn't. And then another important aspect of CFSS is, because it's under a different federal authority than PCA is people are able to pay their parents or and their spouses to be able to provide care. So that's ordinarily not allowed under PCA. It's allowed right now because we have a federal waiver due to the public health emergency, which will be ending soon, of course. So we are very much looking forward to the implementation of CFSS. It requires, I think, around five different federal authorities, including an I, a K, a 1115. So it's been quite a lift to get it approved. But we are in very good terms with CMS. We have weekly meetings with them. We don't know exactly when it's going to be implemented. We continue to have those conversations, and we'll continue to keep you apprised as those projections for approval might change.
Very well said. I think everyone now knows what CFSS is and when it's coming, hopefully soon. Any further discussions from the members? Representative Hansen, do you want to have a closing remarks for
the bill? Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Again, we know this issue has been in front of us for a while, but I ask of you to do your part, and when this comes to the floor, hopefully very soon, I hope I can count on your support. And if you have any questions in the meantime, I would encourage you to reach out. I'm happy to have the conversation. Jeff has been a fabulous advocate for this, and so I just want to uplift him for a moment and Jillian and just say thank you, because storytelling is how we change the world, and these are two of the stories in conjunction with some of our other friends as well. So thank you all for stepping forward to share your stories, and thank you everyone who's been here to support us today.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. I know we've got more work to do, and hopefully we will be able to resolve all those issues before we pick up this bill and send it to the floor. So I renew my motion that House File 1067 be laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill that we have is House File 696. I know the bill author is in a different committee doing what we're doing right now, so he'll be coming here quickly. But I wanted to begin with the testifiers. I have a few testifiers who registered to testify. Mr. Bergeron, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Matthew Bergeron with Larkin Hoffman. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. I'll step in on behalf of Representative Frederick and give kind of an overview of the legislation, and then turn it over to both a PCA recipient as well as an agency manager to kind of hear some of the details in front of you. As you may be aware and as you've likely heard in the past, the PCA program in the state of Minnesota serves roughly 44,000 Minnesotans, individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans, and is one of the key programs that allows individuals to stay in their home. As you've heard throughout this hearing today, PCAs provide a whole variety of services that help people not only navigate just some of the day-to-day realities of life and integrating in the community, but some of the very personal elements of life as well. Unfortunately, PCA services have long lagged other services in the state of Minnesota kind of in this space as far as reimbursement. A lot of what we talk about in disability services, you may hear in the DWRS, the Disability Waiver Rate Setting System, and these are kind of programs that we've pulled out of conventional Medicaid in order to provide a variety of services to individuals with disabilities. The PCA service is a Medicaid service, so it's a little bit different, and as a result, it's not necessarily been a part of some of the systemic innovations, the rate frameworks, and the other methodologies that the legislature and the Department of Human Services has developed over the years to kind of recognize the costs of providing these services. So for example, while PCA services are currently reimbursed at $4.90 per unit or $19.60 an hour, individual home supports without training, formerly called personal supports, in the DWRS system are $8.46 per unit or $33.84 an hour in the metropolitan area, I should add. So you can kind of see the difference there. And when we're talking about a workforce situation, that creates a lot of challenges for recruiting and retaining individuals in this service. The lower reimbursement in this space also has a very disproportionate impact on communities of color in the state of Minnesota. As of 2020, 61% of PCA recipients identified as BIPOC, and 37% of PCA recipients were non-English speaking, whereas as of 2021, 63% of those receiving home and community-based services through the DWRS system were white, and only 11% of those receiving those services reported speaking in English other than language other than English at home. So kind of through history, these programs have grown up in different ways and serve different populations, and so I think the underfunding in this space, or the lower reimbursement, I should say, has had a disproportionate impact. In recent years, the legislature has worked with a variety of advocates in this space and with the Department of Human Services to create a rate framework, a cost-based, data-driven methodology for determining the reimbursement for PCA services. And 2 years ago, a large chunk of that framework was passed into law. However, as many of you may recall, in 2021, there was a variety of workforce, COVID-related, and other issues that were being addressed. And frankly, the things that would build some long-term growth into the reimbursement were unable to be included in the final budget bill at that time. Frankly, the money was needed urgently, and so the legislature made what many of us deemed to be the right decision in making sure that those dollars got out to support the provision of care at the front end. And so that means that the things that would have led to long-term viability and sustainability in this program were left undone. The bill before you today seeks to add those pieces into the framework, the things that recognize that wages in the competitive marketplace change, and therefore there would be language in this bill that takes a look every 2 years at wages in this space, updates some of the Bureau of Labor Statistics data that's used as part of that framework, and takes that going forward. It also recognizes that when we ran this framework 2 years ago, we didn't have enough money to fully fund it. And so there was what's called an implementation factor at the end, a percentage that decreases kind of the total math at the end to kind of where we were in resources. And so one of the things the bill does is it adds a 2% increase every biennium as part of that, trying to move us slowly towards fully funding the framework. So that's kind of where we are on a high level with the bill in front of you. There is an author's amendment, and whenever the chair or Representative Frederick wants to talk about that, there's an immediate rate increase in that I'll address after the other two testifiers provide their commentary as well, if that's acceptable to the chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Bajor. And we're still waiting for the bill author while he's presenting another bill. Hopefully, he'll be with us shortly. Mr. Khalif, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Musab Khalif. I work for Midwest Home Healthcare, a PCA agency founded in Minnesota over 22 years ago. We're also a proud member of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. I'm here today because the PCA program is in danger of collapsing. It is one of the lowest reimbursed HCBS programs, with a current rate of $19.60. Despite this, the PCA program is one of our state's most cost-effective Medicaid programs, serving about 44,000 Minnesotans. The PCA program is also the most diverse program, diverse long-term service program and support in our state, with about 63% of all PCA recipients considered BIPOC. And while we fully support the higher wages and benefits in the CBA agreement, the governor's proposed reimbursement rate increase is woefully inadequate. Since 2015, the PCA reimbursement rate has not kept up with the increases in the wages under the CBA agreement. Taking into account the 2024 and 2025 proposed rate increases, wages have increased by a total of 86%, and reimbursement rates have only increased by 41% since 2015. This is because wage increases have always been greater than the reimbursement rate increases, leading to the erosion of our margins. So much so that in 2024, PCA wages and benefit, i.e. total direct labor cost, will account for 94.11 of our reimbursement rate. This will leave us only 5.9% in gross margins. 5.9% to cover rent, utilities, operating expenses, and administrative costs as well. Given the high workforce shortage or the tight labor market, both traditional and choice PCAs are converging to the same CBA mandated wage. For instance, imagine you're a caregiver looking for work. You go to Indeed.com and you see a PCA choice agency offering $19 of wage. On the other side, you see a PCA traditional agency offering $15 of wage. Obviously, you'll go with the higher wage. This dynamic is what's forcing PCA traditional agencies to move up and compete for that labor or caregivers. So if you look at Indeed's average PCA wage in Minnesota, it's about $15.25. That's exactly the CBA mandated wage agreement for this year. Also, given that all PCA agencies have to pay employer payroll taxes and worker compensation insurance, we can then conclude that both PCA models, i.e. the traditional and choice models, have similar total direct labor cost structures. And in 2024, both PCA models will spend about 94.11% of their reimbursement rate on wages and benefits for PCAs. Thus, if the PCA framework is not funded adequately to cover the additional expenses borne by providers due to the governor's proposal and the CBA wage proposal, both traditional and choice PCA agencies will have negative profits. This will ultimately lead to the collapse of the PCA program, forcing our clients to leave their homes and loved ones to seek care in institutional-based facilities. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Felipe, for your testimony. We'll be coming back to the testifiers and also questions. I wanted to welcome Representative Frederick, and I will begin by moving House File 696 to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, Representative Frederick, introduce your bill, and I know some of your testifiers already did some portion of it. And we also have an A1 amendment. Do you want me to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Members, we have an A1 amendment. I move A1 amendment for Representative Frederick. Any discussions, or did you want to explain the A1 amendment?
Actually, I'll turn it to the testifier to kind of explain.
Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and explain what the A1 amendment is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Matthew Bergeron on behalf of the First Provider Alliance. The A1 amendment does two things. As you heard from Mr. Kalief, there are concerns, and I'm happy to talk through the process a little bit with the way that we have historically calculated what it costs to provide wages when we're pricing out the collective bargaining agreements in this space. And there are a number of assumptions that the Department of Human Services makes as they go through that process that the Provider Alliance has concerns with and believes has an impact on what we would consider an underfunding of the contract. So what the amendment does is it inputs into the rate framework an implementation factor that, based on our internal calculations, we believe would fully fund the costs of providing the wages under the contract, which the Provider Alliance fully supports. And then what it does is it adjusts the dates on the kind of phase-ins that I discussed before into the tails. So it makes an immediate rate adjustment in January 1st of 2024 that we believe would cover the costs of the collective bargaining agreement, and then it puts those automatic kind of cost-based reexaminations of the framework into the tails by adjusting those dates 2 years.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bajan. Just a quick question. I think on page 3, line 14, 15, and 17, we're striking 17.45% to 94.75. Can you explain the rationale behind
that? Yes. So the way the framework works is you start with the Bureau of Labor Statistics wage data, and then there's a number of component values that kind of seek to recognize the cost of providing those services. And so you kind of add all that up, and that gets to what the framework says the reimbursement rate should be for a 15-minute unit. When the framework was put into statute, we didn't have the resources as a state to fully fund that. And so that implementation factor is kind of the artificial depressor on that number. And so that was kind of what got us to the reimbursement that the state was able to put into law 2 years ago as part of the budget bill. So the easiest and most effective way to create a rate increase is to increase that implementation factor, to decrease the total math by less at the end of the calculation. And so what that line in the amendment does is it essentially increases that's the January 1st rate increase there. And so we're just multiplying by we're shrinking it less at the end of the math in order to get there. That would result in a $25.70 for an hour reimbursement rate.
Thank you so much. Any member discussion on A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It never ceases to fail when you have to be in two places at once. The first place is going to go long, and the second place is going to go short. So apologize for being late.
Nothing to apologize. That's part of our job.
So one of the first jobs I ever had was as a PCA. I worked in a home with an individual who had Lou Gehrig's disease. He was fully paralyzed, and the only movement he had in his entire body was his eyes. And so I want you to imagine holding a clear sheet of plexiglass that had different groupings of letters. And as he made eye movements, it would indicate which cluster of letters, and then the secondary movement would mean which letter in that grouping. For him to be able to communicate, we would spell out one letter at a time in order to see what his needs were. And he would sometimes, just as we all do, try to be social and have a conversation. Other times he would say he was hungry or other bodily functions that needed to get addressed. And so that was what I did as a PCA. At the time, I was also young enough. I was starting to go to college. And I had to look at a job that I had to be able to afford college. And that PCA job did not pay well enough, and I moved on. I moved on to a job that paid better, but it was not nearly as rewarding. And it's still, the work that I did as a PCA still impacts me to this day. And so when I have a chance to advocate for PCAs, I want to, because I know the value of the work and the impact of the work. And people who are PCAs, while they can do a varying range of things, they are making people's lives better and doing the best they can to help support people to be able to live in the community. And so that's why I think this bill seeks to establish a framework that says, hey, we need to put our money where our values are. These people are doing very important things, and let's just make sure that in this labor crisis that we are having, we need to make sure that we are staying competitive as possible to put adequate funding in these services. And PCAs is a space that I believe we can do better on, which is what this bill seeks to do, if I were to summarize it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Frederick, for introducing the bill, and quite frankly, you're talking about the passion and the compassion in terms of the work that, you know, you've done and many are still doing in providing PCA. So with that, we'll continue with the testifiers. Mr. Nelson, welcome back, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. I am still Jillian Nelson, and I still work for the Autism Society of Minnesota. And whether you can imagine or not, I am still an autistic adult. I also live with a lot of chronic pain and mobility challenges that are increasing as time passes. I rely on 35 hours a week for PCA care to maintain my independence and autonomy. I depend on my PCAs to make sure I'm eating every day, to help with personal care, and when I'm in pain, they help move my body so I'm not trapped in my bed or my couch or my car. They help me manage my anxiety and keep my home neat. They keep my life organized. They are the foundation to everything in my life that matters to me. Because of this foundation, I have a career I love. Advocating for my community here on the Hill, I have love and family and friends. I have a gym I enjoy, and I engage in my community frequently. Without my PCAs, I would have none of this. I also live with a lot of guilt because this amazing team shows up for me every day, night after night, year after year, and all I can offer in return is a wage that I am embarrassed by. What they bring to my life is worth far more than the $15.25 they make an hour. And there's no room to pay them more because the PCA rate framework has not kept up with the economic changes of our world. The agency that manages my care is only reimbursed $19.60 an hour. What they receive is far less than what my staff deserves to be making, without accounting for the administrative costs they're responsible for. I've had PCA services for 2 years. In that time, I have lost 4 staff members for similar reasons, which Representative Frederick, if you need extra hours, I'm always hiring. I've lost my staff because they cannot live like this. My current team in the last 12 months is 3 individuals. All of them have had to work multiple jobs. 2 of them live with more than 4 roommates to make ends meet. Every single one of them has had to utilize the food pantry at some point. And one of them is currently being garnished for a medical bill because they do not make enough money to make ends meet and pay for unexpected life crises. They want the best for me. They want to keep me stable and secure and happy. They want to keep me being able to show up here every day fighting for our community. I want them to be stable and healthy and happy. I am asking you with my whole heart, for my whole team, and for every other disabled person in PCA out there, please support this bill and increase the PCA rate framework so that we can sustain their workers as they sustain us and they can live stable and secure lives while helping others to do the same. Thank you for your time.
Thank you once again, Ms. Nelson, for the testimony. Please stay around just in case of questions. I have the last testifier listed here, Ms. Kelly. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Kelly. I'm a paid family caregiver and a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Chair Nor and members of the committee, I am here on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. We represent over 50,000 healthcare workers. I am part of our largest unit, which covers almost 27,000 self-directed home care workers, including PCAs and family caregivers. Self-directed workers are hired and supervised by our clients, but we negotiate with the state for a contract that covers wages and benefits. Another group is called traditional PCAs. They are employed by private agencies and are not covered by our contract, but their agencies get the same reimbursement rate. I provide care to my adult son, Jack, who is autistic and has severe mental health disabilities. I am his only paid caregiver right now. Jack is currently a college student and recently received his driver's license and is working towards living independently, which is totally possible for him. This will not be possible, though, without PCA services. I am incredibly proud of the tentative agreement that we came to, and I want to thank Governor Walz and his administration for working with us and being a part of this historic opportunity. Our contract increases the minimum wage from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour by January 1st of next year, and to $20 an hour by January 1st of 2025. It provides a $1,000 bonus for workers after 6 months on the job. It adds a wage scale for experienced workers, and it begins to set up an orientation program with the union and DHS that will help professionalize this industry. Right now, I can care for Jack, but I'm very worried that without at least a $20 minimum wage, there won't be any caregivers that are going to be willing to do this work. As an industry, it is critical that we stay competitive with our wages so that we can address the care crisis that we all have been aware of for quite some time. Without caregivers, people like Jack have fewer options about where and how and with whom they live. DHS has calculated the cost of our contract, and House File 696 appropriates more than that amount. We support any bill that funds our contract. If it appropriates more in order to correct an error that in the DHS projection, we would support that too. Our union wants DHS to accurately project the cost of the contract. We rely on DHS to get this right. Since providers have first raised this issue, we have encouraged DHS to take their concerns seriously. We still think, however, that it is an open question whether their calculation provides sufficient funding to pay for the full value of our wage increase in our contract. If the legislature thinks more money is needed, we recommend for transparency and tracking that the additional money be used to adjust the calculation of the DHS cost projection. That way you will know what you're paying for. Beyond the immediate rate increase to fund the cost of our current contract, House File 696 provides for an ongoing rate increase every 2 years. We support this idea as long as that increase is a floor, not a ceiling. We also want the timing of the rate increases to work with our collective bargaining process. So far it looks good, but we will continue to work with advocates and DHS. To close, we are so incredibly grateful to be here talking about this historic life-changing agreement. In the past, we have been able to do this work because of bipartisan support we've had in the legislature, and I look forward to continuing that during this legislative session and many more ahead. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kelly, and congratulations to SCAU for reaching a historic agreement. So looking forward to more conversation once we get the bill, and we'll start the negotiation second round with legislators to figure out where we end up. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions. I have Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, and thank you for being here to all of our testifiers. I really, really appreciate this bill and all of the work that went into it. Two of our testifiers talked about the math problem. There is a math problem in the reimbursement rate and what needs to be paid. And what needs to be paid is subjective, because it's not only what is required in the contract, but also what needs to happen to ensure that we can actually gather workers. The part of this conversation that I just want to highlight for everyone, if you're not in this world, you maybe don't understand the difference between traditional and choice. And you maybe don't understand what the difference in pay and the lack of appropriate reimbursement has done to traditional PCA. Traditional PCA is the PCA service that is for people who don't have social capital. That is for people who don't have a wonderful mom who can be their caregiver. It's for people who maybe don't have a friend or a neighbor or someone who is willing to do their cares and be paid to do that. Traditional PCA is the safety net for folks who don't have social capital. Understanding that PCA services also are a state plan service and a less expensive service than a waiver or hospitalization. When we do not fully fund traditional PCA and choice, specifically, we are leading people to hospitalization and more expensive, more costly services. They don't have someone who's going to come and help them. They were unable to find someone to be their choice worker. They rely on their traditional PCA agency to have someone come and get them up in the morning. And traditional agencies are closing left and right. Traditional agencies are saying, we're no longer taking traditional clients. We will only accept choice clients because they cannot recruit a workforce to meet the requirements and the needs. If we do not fund these services, we will be funding them somewhere else. We will fund them in the waiver system, we will fund them in our hospitals, and we will fund them in our nursing homes. The people who are relying on these services to stay in their homes, to get up every day, and to successfully participate in our community do not simply go away when we do not fund them. They move into a more expensive, more restrictive service that we also fund. So I just want to make sure that we highlight how important this piece of the puzzle is for all Minnesotans who access services, because this service works with everything from children and itty bitties all the way up to our elders who are not quite to the level of nursing home level of care. But if this service fails, if this collapses, particularly traditional PCA, if it collapses, we will pay for it. It will just be in a different place. So I would strongly encourage everyone to understand how important this piece of the puzzle is to the overall fabric of our disability services and elder services in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks. I have Representative Bay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick. I guess, and again, Representative Hicks brings up some good points, and I think we need to start having these conversations at these committee hearings when we're talking about wages. I completely support the outcome, what we're trying to get to here, but there's now a lot more to this. As new employer mandates are coming, what I'd like to know is, what are the traditional agencies saying about the Paid Family Leave Act and the other things coming that affect payroll? And that's a reality that we have to start talking about. So I fully support paying our folks more per hour, but maybe to either the author or other members at the table, I want to understand how then we're going to give some, but you're going to take some back. And that's how it's going to work, because everybody in the state of Minnesota who's going to have an employee is going to have to face this new payroll tax or paid time off. I want to make sure we talk about that, because it's important to talk about transparency. Somebody talked about this earlier. So either to Mr. Bergeron or to the author, are we honest with this? And also, and maybe to the author, have you talked to the traditional agencies about those bills too, coming this way, at a theater near you? When we can do the reimbursements, I think you've got really bipartisan support there. But I want to make sure we talk about the bigger picture of this too, that it's going to put more pressure on our traditional agencies that are trying to hire these folks, and they're having a heck of a time now. But if we ask them, if they're at the table, and if there's anybody here that wants to talk to this, what do you think about these other things coming? Because it's all part of the package. So I don't know who wants to answer that, Mr. Well, Chair, but this is important stuff. We've got to talk about this honestly.
Representative Beck, I think we stopped together in the workforce and economic development.
Yeah.
For sure, we will get unsafe and sick time on the floor soon.
Yep.
We want to make sure if you're sick that you don't go to work, because you may end up making other people sick. So that is a critical component of doing the services that we need to be talking more about. Likewise, I think the paid family medical leave is coming to us on Thursday, and anyone who wants to testify on that bill, if they haven't registered, they can come and register so we can have more further discussion when we have the actual bill and the impact that it will have on the industry. So it's really important, critical, that we bring that bill before us on Thursday and have more further details rather than putting Rupert Frederick there
yep.
on the discussion. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but I look forward to that conversation.
Mr. Chair, I would just add that regardless of which bill that we would want to talk about, I would say a lot of this is geared towards seeing somebody's humanity, and that's like from a worker perspective, whether it's time off or wages, they're a human being, and so we need to make sure that we're from several different policy positions, as we do in the legislature, try to address as many as we can. So I think for the context of this, I'm happy just to talk about, you know, the PCA rate stuff, but you do bring up valid points too, and I'm sure you'll have a good committee discussion.
And thank you for that reminder. And I don't want to spend all of our time on this, because there are so many bills we have to address with this whole issue, and I happen to be the first one in front of us here. So thank you for allowing me some latitude here, because it's important that we talk to the agencies as well. It's important that we actually ask the DHS question next go around. What is this going to cost DHS, some of these new programs that are coming? We have to make sure it's part of the fiscal note. We have to make sure it's in front of us. And we have to make sure that we hear those people, too, trying to hire people, that what is this going to do? Is this going to help, or is this going to do more damage? Because I like the ideas. Nobody doesn't want to give this time off. Not everybody can do it, however. But, these are discussions I know for another day, Mr. Chair and others. We have to make sure that this is part of our conversations about getting our nursing homes help, getting our PCA's help. This is all really big stuff. I'm very supportive of a lot of the work we're trying to do here, but there's other things on top of this that are coming at us we have to recognize, and at some point we need to have those conversations. So, Mr. Chair, appreciate that. And my last question, I'm sorry if I got time. A lot of the members that were here are union members. There's union contracts that will get changed. And as I understand this, this is going to get automatically updated every couple of years if this passes. What happens to the contracts of folks that are non-union? Do they get paid the same or to that same level of increase? How does that work on the greater scale of this? I assume there's some PCAs that are non-union. So how does this affect them versus our friends on the union side as well?
So the question about the traditional versus choice under the PCA, and I think under the CFSS is agency versus budget, you know, more complicated process. So, Representative Frederick.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that this is geared towards all PCAs, and so whether you are union or not, you should see a benefit from this. I don't know if further commentary would be.
Mr. Bajor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, there's a single Medicaid rate for PCA services, and whether that's paid to a traditional agency or a choice agency. The collective bargaining agreement provides a wage floor for members within a choice agency or another consumer-directed program. But as Mr. Khalif testified, while there isn't a minimum wage for individuals at a traditional agency, there is still the market competition. And so obviously an increase in the minimum wage in the collective bargaining agreement also drives up very much so wages for individuals working at traditional agencies. When we've got, you know, tens of thousands of vacancies, that's I think the wage data that Mr. Khalif testified about shows that while not required, it all the contract drives up wages outside of the collective bargaining agreement as well.
Thank you, Mr. Bajor.
And can I just ask the question, what's the difference between a choice agency or a traditional agency?
Mr. Bajor. Do we want to get from the department? Oh, you can go ahead.
That's your prerogative, Mr. Chair.
No, go ahead, Mr. Bajor.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So a PCA choice agency is what we call a consumer-directed agency. And so the individual has hiring, firing, the individual receiving the services, I should say, has hiring or firing authority, training authority, additional supervision abilities there, where a traditional agency is a more conventional employer in the sense that somebody comes to them and says, I need help, and then they assign an employee if they're able to recruit one for that individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very helpful. I had not heard that before, so I appreciate that information. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think it's page 211, or maybe it's listed in the governor's book. Anyway, you know, I've had, you know, we're talking about the floor. Whenever, you know, we do have the collective bargaining agreement, that's the floor. It comes back to us to decide how much we really value PCA services and how much we're going to put in. So we've got more discussions to have and also to decide where to go next. I see Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to reiterate my point about traditional and choice PCA when I was talking. People who are on traditional PCA might be on it for a variety of reasons, but a lot of times the reason a person is on traditional PCA is because they do not have the social capital to find their own staff. They don't have an auntie, they don't have a mom, they don't have a dad, they don't have a cousin, they don't have friends that they can hire. They do not have the social capital to find their own staff, and so they are then calling and trying to find an agency who will do that for them for a variety of reasons. But those are the folks that are the most susceptible to the collapse landing them in the hospital because they don't have someone who's going to come and pick up the slack. And so that was my whole point about the difference and why we really both are very, very important. But I think it's important that we recognize that by not funding these things, we are hurting our most vulnerable who do not have a social network that will come in and support them. They are reliant on agencies.
Mr. Bajor, what's the percentage of choice versus traditional, if you know the number? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, I would be uncomfortable. Like, I've got a ballpark memory, but I would be uncomfortable saying that. I'm happy to confirm it. There may be somebody from the department that would know. As far, they may know about PCAs versus numbers of agencies, but I would defer to someone there.
Ms. Brown is getting ready to probably give us a number, or maybe we can get it via email. So we'll get it based, you know, so that people are aware of the difference. And most of the union members are in the choice. So that's how mostly the process has been working. So any further discussion, members? I see Representative Clyde, you have a question?
No.
So I don't see any further discussion from members. Representative Frederick, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As it was said, this legislation impacts, I think, itty-bitties to elders, I think is how it was said. And so it's important legislation, and I think the point that was made, too, about how we can make these investments up front and in the end it can save the state money, I think other pieces of the conversation, too, about the other things that impact this are just as valid. But I just appreciate the committee's time and hope to have all of your support.
Thank you so much, Representative Frederick, for bringing this bill forward. We'll have further conversation on this issue as we go forward. So I renew my motion that House File 696, repeat, House File 696, as amended, be laid over. The bill is laid over. So thank you so much, everyone who testified. We don't have any further agenda items. With that, we're now adjourned.